The next matter, number 23-1820, MSP Recovery Claims Series, LLC, et al. Versus Fresenius Medical Care Holdings, Incorporated, et al. At this time, would counsel for the appellants, MSP Recovery Claims, please introduce himself on the record to begin.
Good morning. May it please the court, John Paul Portal, along with my colleagues, Ida Landa of the MSP Recovery Law Firm, and Eduardo Bertrand of the Armis Bertrand and Cohen Law Firm, on behalf of the MSP plaintiff's appellants. Your Honor, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes, you may.
Your Honors, this appeal is predicated on the determination as to whether MSP has sufficiently established class membership as a third-party payor under the versus class definition in order to be entitled to American Pipe tolling. We submit that the record clearly and unequivocally demonstrates that we've met this definition because we have properly pled that MSPs through its assigners are third-party payers in the United States who purchased, reimbursed, and or paid for grant flow on behalf of their enrollees. And it's important for the court to note that under the district court's narrow interpretation of the versus class definition, no individual consumer or any third-party payer could ever satisfy the class definition because only a direct purchaser, like a, quote, dialysis provider, end quote, as suggested by the district court, would fall within the class definition. And the problem with that is that it's plainly wrong, and it arises from a fundamental misunderstanding as to the role that GranuFlow plays in hemodialysis treatment and the payment for that treatment, whether directly by a patient or by the patient's health insurer, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or private health insurance.
I don't want to keep you from arguing this point, but keep in mind, don't you also need to establish as a predicate that there was a class action, pending class action, or putative class action for a long enough period of time to make your filing timely?
Absolutely, Judge Kayada. That is exactly what we submit to the court. And I would turn, Your Honors, to Your Honors' opinion that was authored in NRA Selects and Lexapro Marketing, which we believe is directly on point. Like Painters there, which was a third-party payer, MSP is here alleged injury in the form of payments made for Fresenius' defective GranuFlow. And basically there, the court, adopting the seminal case of American Pipe tolling, says that the individual action survives the statute of limitations defense because the statute of limitation period was told under American Pipe until a prior class action was dismissed in that case, June of 2020. Well, here, under the court's de novo review and looking at the district court's opinion, looking at the record, we allege sufficient facts, which should be taken as true that all reasonable interests should be drawn in plaintiff's favor, that demonstrate
counsel,
class membership.
Do you want us to adopt a per se rule that it takes dismissal, a court order of dismissal, and absent that, you're entitled to American Pipe tolling? But that isn't really the argument in front of us. Here, Versa class action. It appears that there were no assertions of class claims, and as a result, it wasn't, in fact, an ongoing class action during the time periods you're relying on. So could you please address that?
Yes, Your Honor, and thank you for that. The versus class was defined in the original class definition and the original class complaint filed by versus, which talks exactly about what we talked about.
Certain plaintiffs settled and dismissed out of the actions, and then once it became a multi-district litigation, the remaining plaintiffs had to file short forms, and they gave up the class claims. claims in the short forms. So there were no plaintiffs left asserting any class claims during this period.
Well, Your Honor, unfortunately, that's not what the record evidence shows, and that's what we submit in our papers, and I'll walk the panel through that because I think this is a factual determination. The district court here, without explanation or analysis, simply said that when five of the individual named plaintiffs filed short form complaints, they abandoned their class allegation claims. The court also said that in June of 2014, when the four other remaining class plaintiffs, named plaintiffs, filed a stipulation of dismissal, all class claims were abandoned at that point. However, that ignores what the plaintiff's leadership, the PEC, the defense leadership, and the court itself acknowledged subsequent to that. And the court has to take a look at the record evidence. And what do I mean by that? You have to take a look at the subsequent actions that were taken. March 2nd, 2015, at a status conference, the PEC acknowledges the existence of Versus as still a class action complaint. This is after the short form complaints have been filed and after supposed June 2014 stipulation dismissal. Secondly, a month later in April.
Counsel, yes? As I read that, the question came up because the MDL had not notified the Massachusetts district judge that there were three actions filed as class actions. But when it came down to Versa, the counsel for Fresenius said, Your Honor, I don't remember what happened in that case. I'll have to go back and check it. So I don't think that that helps you a lot. So can you move to the next conference?
And that's exactly what happens. In April 10, 2015, a month later, they come back and there the PC said, Your Honor, it's not three. There are five remaining active class actions, including the Versus complaint. The court then went on to ask the district court whether there was a nationwide class and how would that affect it. And importantly, my brother and Fresenius makes the argument that because there's, quote, that the class allegations were not important to short-form complaints, somehow the inference from that is that they were abandoned. I would submit to the court that the equal reasonable inference that could be drawn is that all the parties conceded at that time that the class allegations were indeed still alive and active despite not being adopted as part of the short form complaint.
So help me with this because I think you're getting at the issue which is key, which is did they survive the short term complaint?
That's right.
As I understand it, the short term complaints were filed in response to case management order number 7.
That is correct.
And that case management order, as I read it, says the short form complaint, quote, shall replace the plaintiff's original long form complaint. It will be deemed an amended complaint. And then we have precedent that says an amended complaint entirely replaces the original complaint. So based on all of that, there would be no class claim left once the short form complaints were filed. I then notice in your brief you did cite, I think it's a footnote 17, is it?
I believe it's note 11, Your Honor.
Note 11, okay.
Yes.
In which the court, Judge Woodlock, expresses some uncertainty about just what survived and what didn't survive the complaint. He cites the general rule, and then he says the prior complaint not necessarily superseded for purposes of a motion to dismiss.
That's right, Your Honor. And
so you want us to basically say that, read into that, that it was also not necessarily superseded for purposes of maintaining a class action.
That is right, Your Honor. And it's important because that note that was entered by Judge Woodlock, who's overseeing the entire MDL, who's asking these questions about the continuing ongoing application of class actions in the Fresenius MDL, was in the context of looking at statute of limitations and when it applies when Judge Woodlock was looking at the Mississippi and Massachusetts cases.
Put that in. What we're talking about here is an equitable doctrine, American pipe, that is not a – it looks at whether people who have individual claims can reasonably forestall filing their claims because we don't want them to all necessarily have to file them prematurely if they're going to be a class action.
Right.
So I didn't find in your brief any analysis of why, given that case management order number 7, given the 5 dismissals and then the 4 short-form complaints, why counsel with individual claims sitting looking at an MDL action that at that point consisted of all individual claims would think they could go years of not filing anything as no class action is being pursued.
Well, Your Honor, as set forth at the status conference by even the plaintiff's leadership, the purpose of filing that class action was for tolling the statute of limitations. It was acknowledged by all the parties. And what's more important, Your Honor, is that here there was no ultimate decision by any court whether a denial of class cert, briefing on class cert, or dismissal of class cert, which goes to Judge Lynch's initial question, which is it the bright line only upon dismissal? We understand it's not. There's other factors that could be taken. We submit one of the arguments that are raised is whether there's a diligence requirement. We argue that there is not under American Pipe and China Agritech. However, assuming arguendo that this panel decides that for equitable tolling there has to be a diligence requirement, we believe that the court's dismissment opinion, which cites the Fourth Circuit's opinion in Bridges, which adopts an objectively reasonable reliance standard, is instructive. And why is that instructive under the facts of this case? Because not only in 2015 on 2 separate occasions is there acknowledgement of the existence of an ongoing active versus class, but then in April of 2017, the defendants themselves file an omnibus motion to dismiss active plaintiffs and class actions. And then in April of 2019, they file a motion to sever plaintiffs in multi-plaintiff cases and class actions and specifically identify persons. And that's at the record at 217. And subsequent to that, in April of 2019, there's a second stipulation of dismissal of the 4 named persons plaintiffs. So how can you have a stipulation dismissal in June of 2014 and then have another exact one in April of 2019, 5 years later, and say the first one foreclosed it, but not the second one? And so looking at it from an objectively reasonable reliance standard, there is record activity where the MDL is saying, hey, these class actions, we're not going to address them now. We'll deal with the individual plaintiff's claims, but we'll leave that for later.
So what do we do with, as I look at this record, the day that the short-form complaints were filed, and then I read the case management order number 7,
right.
It seems indisputably clear if I stop there that there's no class action because the case management order specifically provides for our rule that the amended pleading wipes out the prior one. And indeed, the short form complaints actually incorporate the new long form pleading, not the old one. So let's assume that as of that date, no person could objectively think there was still a class action. Come forward in time, though, and as you note, things are then said in conferences. There's a docket entry suggesting a class action still continues, and then there's the motion papers filed by the defendant. So it's, and then there's the judge's footnote 11. So right. It starts to be subsequently a lot messier as to whether there's a class action pending or not. How do I then factor that in? In other words, the change in chronology where there's a period of time where it appears clear there's no class action, followed by a period of time suggesting maybe I shouldn't have read that period of time that way. How do I then roll that into the equitable analysis of whether it was objectively reasonable for class members to sit there for years with individual claims as other individual claims are being processed in the MDL?
Because one way to reconcile that distinction, Your Honor, and I think it's important, is again turning back to Judge Woodlock's note 11, which says the master complaint is an administrative device. And I understand what the CMO 7 says, but at the same time, Judge Woodlock also recognizes that the long-form complaint isn't always superseded, especially at the motion-to-dismiss stage. And that's where we're at, and that's critically important in this analysis that we have here in this case. It is actually messy.
He doesn't just say motion-to-dismiss. He refers to the motion-to-dismiss with respect to fraud claims.
And specifically,
because you've got
statute
the specific pleading requirements of particularity for fraud, so he's looking back.
That's right.
But he doesn't say anything about class pleading, so we're kind of left with the continuing ambiguity I outlined earlier.
That's right, Your Honor. And so we need to take it all in full context and looking at the entire record. I mean, we can't simply just ignore the activity if the court and the parties, both plaintiffs and defendants, really believe.
Counsel, at those status conferences where at least one lawyer for Fresenius made clear that the short form complaint had given up all class claims, your MSP's lawyers said to the judge, well, we have no plan at present or in the foreseeable future to be pursuing any class claims, but maybe someday we will. That doesn't strike me as being sufficient to continue the class action in light of the clear law on the short form complaint. And so it strikes me that it would be contrary to what American Pipe is trying to accomplish to give lawyers that amount of power by merely saying, well, Judge, someday we may come up with a class plaintiff and we may try to amend again. How does that serve the purposes of American Pipe?
Your point is well taken, Your Honor, but I would submit to you that at that status conference, counsel for defendant didn't say that the class claims were abandoned by adopting the short form. It just says they weren't alleged in the short form. There's no further explanation. There's no meaning behind that. It is just simply a statement of fact. They're not in there. Why is that important? Because the short form complaint is a template. And if you look at the template and look at the record evidence for the short form complaints, there's nowhere where there's contemplated that you could check the box, like you do in a short form complaint for all the other causes of action, to adopt a class action. It's simply not there. Whether intentional or by omission, we don't know, but that's what we have to live by because that's what was there. And so you have to then look at what are the subsequent actions taken, right?
Are you suggesting the court has booby-trapped counsel by docket order describing what the short-form complaint has to be?
No, Your Honor. I think it's just the opposite. I think that there really wasn't any meaningful thought, because remember, the CM order is also kind of taken by what the party submissions are. And at the time, the PC was really concentrated on direct individual claims, right? So it's not that it's booby-trapped, but rather it's just saying it wasn't something that was necessary to contemplate one way or the other, whether abandoned or continuing active. And, you know, it reminds me of that old saying, and it's taking a quote from Ian Fleming that says, you know, once is an accident, twice is coincidence, three times is a pattern. There's a continued pattern by the plaintiffs and the defense to continue to litigate the case through 2019 as if there's an active versus class action complaint.
Thank you.
If it was done in 2014, why would they still be litigating the case? It defies all reason. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the appellees please introduce himself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors. It's Jim Bennett for Fresenius, the appellee. May it please the court. Focusing first on the question that has generated most of the dialogue here today, I think there is simply no question that we don't believe American Pipe tolling applies to MSP's claims at all, as the court's aware from our first point. But even if it did apply, there wasn't enough tolling here because June of 2014 is the end. It's clear to me that the panel is very aware of the record, and so I won't necessarily repeat all of that. But in March of 2014, five of the plaintiffs filed short-form complaints that did not carry forward class allegations. And we said at the hearing where that was discussed in April of 2015, in all the other cases, short-form complaints have been filed, but the class action allegations were not imported. And that's at Appendix 196, and I know Judge Lynch and all of you have read that closely. Then in June of 2014, the remaining plaintiffs all dismissed their case in total. And when you look at this entry that they talk about, that there was a stipulation of dismissal in April of 2019, that's at Appendix 135, and the docketing clerk there said stipulation of dismissal filed, note, originally filed on June 27, 2014 in the MDL docket. So what you're seeing after the short forms were filed and what you're seeing after the dismissal is, I would say, very routine docket management by a judge who's been asked to preside over thousands and thousands of cases. We still did have, at the time, the short form complaints that had the same docket number, and Judge Woodlock was working through those and dealing with that and ultimately getting those dismissed. But no reasonable lawyer or client in any situation could think that as of June of 2014, there were class action allegations actually pending in the Bursas case. That's what China Agritech says. It needs to be pending as a class action. The cases talk about you need to have objective, reasonable reliance interests that are to be protected. And if you don't look at that as a situation there where they lost their class character, no one would objectively, reasonably rely on it, you end up with all of the things that Justice Blackmun's concurrence in American Pipe and Justice Powell's concurrence in the early cases could lead to abuses, which is, I think, why in 2017 and 2018, you know, the newer Supreme Court cases like CalPERS talk about this being an equitable doctrine where you have to look into whether there was diligence, whether this is the type of thing that American Pipe is intended to do. And I think it's also important to understand we're dealing with the mass tort context, and you guys saw in our brief, we cite cases that talk about the idea that there is no real way to ever expect that there's going to be a class mass tort ever going to be pursued because all of the causation issues are individualized, the injury issues are individualized, the circumstances are individualized, and we cite Hendricks and Jolly and a Reslin case that talk about that as a important overlay.
Let me run by you the issue that's concerning me. If anyone is harmed at all by an overextension or a broader extension of American Pipe, it would be the defendant, no one else. The plaintiffs all have an interest in having it go on as long as possible. So when we look through this record, the defendant is not actually seeming to be vigorous and outspoken in suggesting that there's no class action. There are several conferences, I think at least two, where statements are made by plaintiff's counsel that there is a class action. In fact, at one point they say there's five of them. And in those particular conferences, there's no counter by defense counsel. And then on April 10 of 2014, there's actually a docket entry that says motion for class cert expected. And there's no objection to that. So what are we to make of that in adjudicating and balancing the equitable considerations that I would think would be appropriate here?
I think I'll refer, so we can talk about both of those. The docket entry talking about versus, I think the answer to that is to actually look at the transcript that where the discussion happened. And in those March and April
was that transcript in the docket such that someone outside the case looking at it would see the conversation?
For sure, and also everybody's here. I mean, you can't believe the numbers of people attending this. Usually the transcript hits like a week later. But I was at all of those conferences, and we have people dialing in from all around the country, and everybody is allowed to attend telephonically, and Judge Woodlock had set that up. But what the plaintiff's leadership actually said at that conference is, it is the view of the leadership, and these are the people court-appointed to be speaking on behalf of everyone at these conferences. It is the view of the leadership, at the present time, we are not planning on moving for certification. And we knew at all times on the defense side that there was never going to be a valid class action in a mass tort context, and so what we were focused on is moving the individual cases through, which for Burgess was handled, you know, essentially exactly how it should have been, which is there's nine people, four people decided they didn't really have a claim, and so those were dismissed in June of 2014, gone. And then they abandoned their class claims, did their short forms, and became part of the mass tort. And we did say in that April hearing, when they came up with a variety of class actions, people were just looking. The conferences involved, as a practical matter, a lot of Excel spreadsheets of dockets where Judge Woodlock and his staff were trying to just figure out who's doing what and what cases are out there. And we identified these that had been filed. But in April of 2015, it says that I believe it says very clearly that the Burgess case certainly has been resolved as a class action because the short form complaints have been filed and the class action allegations were not imported. And needless to say, an observer.
Does it have the first part of the words you just said? It just says.
What page are you on?
Appendix 196.
Yeah.
Okay. The court is, they're talking about the various cases. Rodriguez is one and Bryston is another. And the defense counsel says, no, well, actually, there are short forms that have been filed on behalf of the individual named plaintiffs in every case except the Rodriguez case, which is not at issue here, which is the consumer class action. In all the other cases, short form complaints have been filed, but the class action allegations were not imported into the short form complaint.
And you want us to read into that the further inference that therefore they've been dropped.
I think that's exactly what we were intending to say.
There would have been no purpose of saying that otherwise.
Right, and I think that's what Judge Woodlock wanted to know. He wanted to know, do I actually have some multi-plaintiff case out there? Or like, you don't have it. There's this one out there, Rodriguez, but as to all the other ones, what was important about the filing of the short form is we had 13,000 lawsuits, and there's a lot of docket management going on. And what was important about it for the judge, and certainly when we were trying to communicate to the judge, is we have everybody into their own case now, and we're going to work through them. We're going to try the ones that need to be tried. We're going to move for summary judgment if they don't want to participate. Ultimately, in 2016, we had a master settlement agreement. Then we tried cases in this courtroom, which I tried, of people who didn't participate in that. But what happened in this 2014 timeframe for Burgess, and certainly for most all the cases, is every case got its own notation so that it could proceed through to resolution, which in the Burgess case was dismissal for four, gone, five individual cases via the short form. And our whole intention with talking to Judge Woodlock about his docket is to say there is no class action for Burgess. They're all short forms now, and they're pursuing their own cases. Now, admittedly, the District of Massachusetts Clerk's Office still had a case number that was Burgess with the multiple plaintiffs. And that was why there's this motion to sever and break that up and administratively closing out the docket. There was no substance to it. There was never a class certification motion filed by the plaintiffs. Every time Judge Woodlock brought it up, it's like it's a placeholder, which American Pipe says it shouldn't be, right? American Pipe and all the Supreme Court cases say the abuse is if you file it as a placeholder and then don't do anything with it, that's the opposite of the purpose of American Pipe. And we understood that all of these were going to be individual cases. We tried individual cases. We moved for summary judgment. Judge Gorton eventually got the docket. He granted summary judgment on the cases, and each case was resolved on its own without any collective.
Can I just move you back? And I may have missed this, but you said you were going to explain the ECF docket notation in light of that conference.
Yeah. I think what happened in the April conference was that the PEC actually said we're not intending to move on class certification. So, however, whatever went into that docket entry on that, I think it was more of a note that those exist as opposed to saying we expect them, because the plaintiff's lawyers actually said the opposite there. But they were pending and they were there. But as of the date, anybody looking at the Burgess cases knew there was no class action at that point in time, and in fact, four of them had already been dismissed at that point. And I think you have to look at both, and you can see in the docket the transcripts there, and this is here, and that no one was going to pursue a class action in these cases for the reasons that the cases we cite talk about where, for example, California Supreme Court said, we're not going to do American Pipe, and we're certainly not going to do it in a mass tort context, where no reasonable outside lawyer could ever think there's going to be a class action. These are individual people who have injuries, and they're going to be separate trials. Now, you wouldn't have to reach this, of course, if you rule on the first basis of Judge Gorton's ruling, right? Judge Gorton looked at the versus class definition and said it's for people who purchase the product that's at issue. And I think it's an important distinction that gets muddled because, like, Solexa, for example, were pharmaceuticals where the plaintiff who was trying to sue actually pays for it. These are medical devices that are just used in a dialysis treatment. None of these assignors purchased it. None of the individual plaintiffs purchased it like you would a drug. It's just used in a dialysis treatment. And so none of them are purchasers. And what he does is quote paragraph 3 and 5 of the MSP complaint to say, you're really going after health insurance payments for ancillary health care issues. And so you're not a named plaintiff in the Bursas case because Bursas was purchasers of the products, Granuflow. None of these people they're trying to represent are purchasers of the product, Granuflow.
Were the plaintiffs in Bursas actually purchasers of the product?
No, and that's another reason why an objective person would never think a class was going to go forward. They were nine people who were actually individually injured. If you were objectively looking at is Bursas out there protecting their rights, you would say the class says individual patients and third-party purchasers. They didn't even have a class rep who was a third-party purchaser. There is no way you could look at that versus complaint and think that's going to be a class action that's going to protect me because they didn't even have a class rep that did that, and that's why they very quickly abandoned all of those claims and went to the short forms. They didn't even have a commercial plaintiff in the case. And patients aren't purchasers either. Patients get the dialysis treatment, they get charged for the dialysis treatment, not for Naturalite or Granuflow, which were the products. And as Judge Gorton found also, you know, I think after Agritech and CalPERS, you know, there's just, I think, really no question that there is this diligence requirement. And I think you can really blend...
That diligence requirement, do we assume it's counseled? The diligence that's required, do we assume it's counseled?
Well, I think that's an interesting
question. A lot of things we're talking
about,
an individual would have no idea how to read a docket, what a case management order is.
Well, I think what you'd find in this particular case, you might want to write narrowly on it, but this particular case are allegedly health plans who are very sophisticated litigants who are bringing cases and monitoring these things. The assignors are supposed to be like HMOs and things like that. So I don't think you have to, like, try to write something that would say we're holding individual plaintiffs to this. Because when you look at who the assigners are, they're some of the, you know, they're very sophisticated entities who are in litigation with people like us all the time. But the diligence requirement, to me, I think the best way to look at it is not to say it's like necessarily a subjective issue to look at, but to look at the standards that the cases talk about is like, when would anybody really looking at this situation objectively believe my rights are being protected? And then you look at the docket and you say, if you didn't act at those times, you weren't diligent. You weren't diligent is one way to do it, which is what Judge Gorton did. Or you say, the case lost its class action character by that time, and so the tolling has all stopped. And I don't know that there's necessarily a substantive difference between deciding it on the second prong of objective knowledge, objective indications that it's still a class, or lack of diligence. I think those really kind of merge together, and Judge Gorton did a nice, we view as a very good job of ruling on that basis on a second ground. So we think all of the grounds are right, and that this case should be affirmed for the reasons that he said, plus what we've been talking about today, which is no objective person would think there's a class.
If I might, you have made the argument that this is equitable tolling, diligence is required. In every other area of the law where we have equitable tolling, the appellate standard of review is abuse of discretion, which of course includes clear errors of law. But the parties seem to agree here, and as best I can tell, every case on point assumes it's de novo review in the Court of Appeals. Is this just the law hasn't caught up with the latest iteration of American Pipe? I'm sort of wondering where the future is going to be in this area of law.
I think that's a great question, because what we saw was a lot of, you know, when American Pipe came out, and then Crown Cork, people are looking at it as more legal in nature, and there was, you know, cases from the district court here that did that, and then it's clear that the law has moved more in our direction since that date. And I think we have both the idea of an equitable tolling on abusive discretion and clear air, and then we have the concept of a motion to dismiss, which is traditionally reviewed de novo. But where I think those kind of come together here is the judge on diligence is really reading his or her own docket and looking at what an objectively reasonable person would conclude at that time. And so,
you know, it was exactly on the diligence point that I wondered if some sort of deference was owed.
Of course, here we don't have, ideally, the own docket, because there was a switch in judges.
We had a switch of judge, but we understood they, you know, talked a lot, and that at least he told us that at the conference on the record. And also, it's his own court, right? So it's the court records of the District of Massachusetts. So I think when a judge is looking at the district court's docket, their district court judge, the MDL has assigned the case to them, that certainly our view would be it would be highly unlikely they would make a mistake in reading that docket and understand the impact of it. But whether that means it's abusive discretion versus Rule 12b-6 de novo, I think it doesn't matter for the outcome in this case. But I could see a situation if you got past the motion to dismiss and a judge made some findings, then you would be in your court situation, Judge Lynch.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, if counsel for the appellants would please reintroduce himself on the record. He has a 3-minute rebuttal.
Thank you. May it please the court. John Paul Portal with MSP Recovery again. I'd just like to take up the last point raised by Judge Lynch on the standard of review. We do submit, based on our papers, because we're on a 12b-6 motion to dismiss, that it is a de novo review in this case. However, we do acknowledge that there is case law and out of this circuit that for the application and rejection of equitable tolling, there is case law to suggest that it's an abuse of discretion standard. The problem that we have here is that there's not a sufficient record or explanation or analysis by the district court for this court to say whether there's any deference really allowed, because all the court found was you slept on your rights because the short form complaints were filed, a stipulation was filed in 2014, period, end of story. And there's no further explanation beyond that or analysis. And that's the problem that the panel would have in terms of looking at it. So we believe that given the procedural posture, the history of this case, given the fact that Judge Gordon assumed this case much years later, it would be de novo. However, but you know, we obviously defer to the court and to what standard it applies. We believe that even giving some deference, it should change the outcome here, and a ruling should be in our favor. The other thing that I'd like to point out, which Your Honor, Judge Kayada raised, which is CMO number 7. Interestingly, CMO number 7 was adopted in February of 2014. Yet, it's a year later, in April and March and April 2015, at status conferences, where this issue of the existing master class complaints are raised. And then even more importantly, it is the memorandum in order, which is also in 2015, after CMO number 7, which is note 11 by Judge Woodlock, looking at statute of limitations, which he says the quote, that the long-form complaint isn't necessarily superseded by the short form. And so we have to take a look in total at the record evidence that this panel can do under a de novo review and looking at all the actions taken by the parties. And while my brother tells the court that based on that April 2015 status conference, it was known by everybody in the whole world and any objectable, reasonable attorney or plaintiff that the class claims were abandoned, is simply not true. That's not what the record said. And I'd like to read to you because I think it's very important. Words matter. And what was held at that status conference is important. And this is at the record starting at page 194. And the court asks, so then we move on to some sort of joint report. Was there a writing on the joint report on class actions, or is this an oral tradition? The response is, well, this is all tradition, Your Honor. I can now report that there are five class actions that are currently in the MDL. And it goes on to say there's the Bursas case that was filed in the Eastern District of Louisiana. But importantly, he continues on the record at page 195 at line 4. I haven't been able to obtain the consent of everybody or everybody's view, including Bursa's plaintiff's attorney. But it is the view of leadership here that the PC, that at the present time, we are not planning on moving for certification. But these cases were filed for the most part with respect to the issue of equitable tolling for the purpose of the limitations period. And for now, our purpose is just to leave them as they are. And that's what happened. That's the objectively reasonable standard. That's exactly what occurred. So once again, Your Honors, we submit that we rely on our papers, the issue of subrogation, whether it was raised in the answer brief, whether we properly stated a claim. We believe that's not before the panel. We also believe that amendment should have been given, and we stand by those arguments in our papers.
One quick question about the MDL proceeding.
Sure.
There were thousands of plaintiffs.
Individual plaintiffs, yes. And there is Jim Dugan, who represented the Bursas complaint, is typically, he represents many, many third-party payers throughout all MDLs. And importantly, Your Honor, as those who have tried and been participating in MDL mass torts all over the country, as my brother alluded to, TPP cases, typically and traditionally, are always kicked to the back of the line. And we see that the most glaring example of that is in the NRA opioid case in front of Judge Polster. TPP claims are always the last ones to get tried.
But isn't that of some significance that, I mean, the classic American pipe, you're looking at a class action or an aggregation of class actions, and the theory is, let's not have class members come forward now with their complaints while we're still deciding on a class, because if there's a class, then they'll get the opt-out, opt-in procedure or whatever.
Right.
But here you have people outside the proceeding looking not just at a class action, but looking at thousands and thousands of individual cases, which would seem to be antithetical to the whole notion behind American pipe, and would give some pause to think, why am I waiting if thousands of others are actually being processed by the court?
Because there's a very critical distinction, and that is that they are personal, individual claims being brought by members who were injured, members of this MDL, individual personal claims. But the class complaint seeks different set of damages. They're economic losses.
But I thought you said persons with economic losses were in the MDL with individual claims.
There are. So think of your typical, and this is why it's important. There was, and how we got involved, was in 2018, after the Master Settlement Agreement, there was set up a PLRP, a Private Lien Resolution Plan. So that deals where a TPP has a right of subrogation reimbursement for the medical expenses it paid on behalf of its enrollee for an individual who filed a suit in the MDL and settled their claim. Our case, like set forth in Bursa's class definition, which is, quote, all consumers and third-party payers, who purchased, reimbursed, and or paid for natural and granule flow. And that's what we have here. We're seeking claims for those who aren't part of the PLRP. Our enrollees, which we paid as part of hemodialysis treatment for the granule flow and the natrolite, that ultimately had injuries that we also paid for. And you could separate, that's a question of damages. If the court says, hey, you're not entitled to recover for the accident-related medical expenses because they had a heart attack or a stroke, that doesn't take away an existing claim on their Bursas for the actual payment of the hemodialysis treatment, and that still remained alive. There are different elements of damages, and that's also important for this court to take note of.
Thank you. Any more questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Both counsel. It was very helpful.
Thank you.